How are we doing? I didn't know whether I should be offended when I was asked to give the view of the big gas supplier or not. So I chose not to be anyway, but... I'm not going to talk about the actual incident itself. That's sort of not appropriate, but I will kind of look briefly at the sort of operational sort of impacts from the upstream point of view, I guess, and then what I want to do is sort of look forward to security supply and where developments seem to be going. Oops, there you go. Okay. So this is the only slide I've got on this, or the actual operation during the crisis period itself. In terms of the positives, I think, you know, we were pretty pleased with the actual cooperation, if you like, from a sort of an upstream sort of perspective. We got together pretty quickly, I think, with the pipeline and everyone, and things went. It was a pretty good response. As Mark's already said, the plant, we kind of pushed it almost outside its boundaries. 750 terajoules a day was a big... That was a big ask, and I think our operators... I certainly want to acknowledge their kind of... the commitment that they put in at the time to sort of getting the plant to where it got to. I think they did an excellent job. And I think, as Mark's already said as well, market forces for the large consumers kind of played pretty quickly, and they sorted their act out very well. It's the kind of the volatility in the south that was sort of really the issue. Just focusing on the sort of from the negatives point of view, it got sorted fairly quickly, but initially, particularly, there was the times when we'd do 750 one day and we could only get 650 terajoules into the pipeline the next day because not necessarily everyone, I think it was the south again, were taking necessarily all their allocation. I think that was a real learning, and it got sorted pretty quickly. But initially, there were days when we could have been producing potentially up to an extra 100 terajoules a day, but we weren't able to get it into the pipeline because not necessarily everyone was taking what they were nominating they were going to take. That got, I think, you know, within a week or so, that got sorted. But initially, there was a little bit tough. I think we've also talked about the sort of transparency. There was certainly some sort of tension among the smaller customers around sort of allocation methods, and this whole issue of sort of, you know, the visibility of data and the like. That created sort of tension. The bulletin board, I think, was kind of invented a bit on the fly as well. So while I think it was a good initiative. And this isn't a shot at DBP, by the way. They have their own emergency response sort of process already well established. So I'm not sort of saying... I mean, they supported the bulletin board, but in the sense that it was kind of invented on the fly, it cut across other people's processes. And so it probably... Because it wasn't an established sort of mechanism that we were using, it wasn't effective as it could have been if it was something that we were already sort of using on a regular basis. I think the impact on residential users... they behaved very responsibly. I guess, sort of from a personal perspective, I kind of thought there was kind of a little bit of political motivation in some of the things that went on there. I think they responded admirably, but I felt that the residential users perhaps the role of residential was perhaps over exaggerated. When we look at direct gas use from residential users, it's 3% of total gas. When we look at the electricity, small users plus small business runs at about 11%, I think, of gas. So total of around about 14% of the total gas supply you could sort of attribute to residential. So they play a role, but you certainly wouldn't want to have people switching from gas to electricity, as we've sort of heard. I mean, it wouldn't... And I just don't think there was enough sort of education in that space going on. The bottom line for me was sort of the absence of an integrated plan. I guess when I first came to the North West Shelf Venture in 94, there was a plan. People were very sensitive to the idea that because we were relying really on one plant at that time, there were sort of emergency plans sort of available. And I'm just not sure, I didn't get the feeling that plan's really been kept as alive as it could be. And I'll talk about that a little bit further on as we go through. I want to spend some time looking at the sort of future of security of supply from an upstream perspective. So this is about gas into the pipeline rather than beyond that. Just first to make the point, and I'll come back to this, that the risk of a production disruption is real. And I think because we've had 24 years of sort of almost uninterrupted supply, the idea that we could go out for sort of 6 months is sort of not something that was really... You know, it's such a low probability event, but has such a major impact, and they can often get sort of overlooked. And I just wonder whether we got a little bit sort of almost too complacent with the sort of high reliability that we've had. I want to talk a bit about the market characteristics. It's certainly, there is additional supply coming that will give us more diversity of supply, but I don't think it's going to substantially change our situation in the short term. But as we get out towards 2015, we'll see that there are potentially more supply options. But given the current financial crisis, some of that's at risk now. So we might be actually living with a sort of almost the status quo for quite some time, potentially. And I would like to make a point about to get a significant new LNG, new domestic gas supply up. There is a role for LNG there to play, and potentially, you know, the Gorgon project might be the way we can get ourselves a new reliable large supplier of domestic gas as well. So let's just hang on, wrong way. Just to touch on the characteristics of the gas market. I mean, from the perspective of upstream, let's just look at where the gas actually comes from. 63% of Western Australia's gas supply comes through the North West Shelf Venture, through that one hub at the North West Shelf project. Two domestic gas trains. Varanus Island itself, again, two ventures, the Harriet Venture and the John Brooks Venture, produces 34%, and then there's that little bit of the Perth Basin that's sort of the remainder. I mean, effectively, that's the picture. So right now, we are totally dependent on two hubs. If we look at it from a supply point of view and the ability to create new hubs, it's pretty hard. When we look at the West Australian market, effectively, we see that five customers actually take 72% of the gas. And that's historically been the problem in terms of creating new supply. Unless you can aggregate sufficient volume to underpin a new development, new developments haven't happened. And that, hence, our sort of the situation that we've really just got the two hubs at the moment. And we've had the situation where these two hubs have been created, and progressively over the past 7 years or so, with the sort of the boom in mining particularly, we've seen the capacity, and the capacity is that the blue line on that chart, gradually being consumed as sort of new projects come on, take more and more gas, to the point now where those hubs are both effectively full. And we've kind of had the crisis that we've been talking about for the last 18 months or so about where's the next bit of gas coming from. And then the response from the upstream that says, well, at $2, $3 a gas, we can't possibly develop any of that stuff because it's uneconomic. And so we've got ourselves into this sort of bind where, from the upstream perspective, it was uneconomic to develop further gas. From the downstream perspective, we've been gradually consuming all the existing capacity, and we reached that kind of crunch point where we needed to see new developments happen, but we needed almost that kind of crisis around pricing that we had to sort of see new developments progress. I would say that over that period of time, though, we've had 24 years from the North West Shelf, for example, with in excess of 99% reliability. I'd also make the point that over that period of time, if we look at the North West Shelf, the facilities have got increasingly more complex. So while the risk that we had at the beginning of an outage might have been new equipment, we've had stable operations, but in the process we've added on a train 3, a train 4, a train 5 and some extra kit on the North West Shelf. If we look at the Varanus Island facility, since that was constructed, we've seen things like East Bar added, we've seen the John Brooks development. So these facilities themselves have become increasingly complex over time. So you could argue perhaps that the risk associated with supply has probably got has increased over time due to the complexity of these facilities. And of course we did have that major incident that Mark referred to from the North West Shelf, which created quite a stir at the time because it was the first significant outage we'd had in the North West Shelf, I think, and it was a 2 or 3 day outage, and it was a bit of a kind of a warning about because we didn't respond real well, I don't think, and yet clearly here we are 6 months later dealing with a much more substantial outage. So I think we probably had become a little bit accustomed to this sort of reliability of supply. Now, there is sort of hope because there are new developments happening, but they're happening in sort of in a different price paradigm world. And I guess the question is going to be whether those curves there on the top right, what they're going to do. Because at the moment, what's sort of stopping, or what's been stopping development of additional gas in Western Australia has been particularly the cost of capital, or the cost of developing new developments. So what we've got there is a chart that's prepared for by a company called CIRA, which is sort of an index, if you like, of capital costs for offshore and onshore developments, upstream and downstream developments, benchmarked against 2000. And you can see that since 2000, we've seen something like a 200% increase in the cost of developing, a new gas field. Because of the high oil prices, global demand for sort of construction, et cetera, has just driven the sort of pace of development. People don't have capacity. So because the capacity is sort of not there, they're able to wrench the prices up, and basically that's what we end up with. That plays a huge role in sort of where our gas prices are at the moment. So, you know, up until 2005, we had enough capacity in the system. In 2006, still the prices were relatively low, and then really with rising costs and with that capacity being consumed, we sort of a situation where gas prices started to rise sharply in WA. Average prices, as you'll see down the bottom, are still pretty low. I mean, the average annual price in WA, according to the DOIR report for this year, was still around $3. But we know that new contracts that were being let more recently are substantially, you know, two or three, four times in excess of that average. So as a result of that, new gas developments have been triggered. But those developments are inherently more expensive because of these capital cost issues. And there's a supply time lag. I mean, there's a three-year lag between the sort of time to start a development and actually delivering that thing online. So we're not going to see any change in the situation in WA, really, for 3 years anyway, in terms of the reliability of our supply. Just to sort of make the point about this kind of new gas paradigm that we're dealing with, these are some slides I've sort of used before, but they basically show you that the gas that we're now finding is much more expensive gas. The gas that we used to find was in this stuff. It's gas in the inboard, you know, like in sort of around the Apache areas and Northwest Shelf. It's sort of low development cost stuff, and therefore relatively low cost to produce. What we're now finding, though, is most of the gas is in this outboard. It's in deeper water. The gas is drier. It doesn't have the condensate in it, and the condensate adds a lot of value. It's dirtier. It has higher CO2 levels. It has higher nitrogen levels. And, of course, because it's outboard, it's more distant. We have these sort of 4Ds, and those things, when you look at that chart there on the right-hand side, are actually driving the costs up. If we look at where we were on the inboard, the blue, the old paradigm, and we normalise the sort of just on the same basis, the economics, we see we're looking at an increase in gas prices, and you can see the big contribution that capital cost escalation makes in the order of 3 to 4 times increases. Capital costs, this is 2007. Since then, we've seen another 20% increase in capital costs since 2007. So now the big question mark is what happens now with the kind of the crisis and whether you know, the slowing down in demand, the dropping in steel prices and things is going to bring those curves down quicker and make perhaps you know, some of these prices more achievable. Okay, so if we move forward, what's our supply outlook? And this, again, what I've done here is just model a 1%, 4%, 6% market growth. I can tell you that before I left Woodside back in April, when the world was quite different, we walked around all the various potential purchases of gas, and we'd assessed that there was something in the order of 500 to 600 terajoules risked of demand between now and 2015. And around 50% of that was from resources in the north of the state, from miners. I guess the question today is whether that number is 600 or whether it's zero or a very small sort of a number. And we've just heard from Alcoa, for example, that the Wagerup refinery is being put on the back burner. So, you know, if we look at a 1% growth world, the red line, between Reindeer and Macedon, we've probably got it covered, but Reindeer and Macedon isn't going to make a big deal of difference to the reliability of supply. What I've done on the bottom here is plot pie charts that show today 63% of our production coming through the Northwest Shelf Venture Hub and 34% through the Varanus Island Hub. By 2012, once we get this new facility Reindeer in and potentially Julimar, you'll see that Devil Creek Hub, the new, you know, the new hub that Apache is building, will be something like about one third of the state's gas supplies, with Northwest Shelf still supplying around 46%. By the time we get out to 2015, if all those developments were to proceed, we'd actually have a pretty good system with some real inherent sort of redundancy in it, in the sense that there'd be multiple suppliers, and that if one went out, we'd probably be able to cover it from amongst the others. But I, you know, the question mark is whether we actually achieve that sort of 6% growth now in the current economic world, or whether we're really looking more at a world like, you know, maybe this one at best. So while the outlook is that there will be more suppliers, we might see a little bit, you know, maybe one third, one third, one third sort of reliability on the different hubs, we are going to be very much dependent on effectively three sites for the foreseeable future. I suppose the good thing with new hubs developing, though, is we are seeing new infrastructure coming in as well, and with new infrastructure, new pipelines, for example, at Devil Creek, and with pipelines perhaps across Farrow Island associated with the Gorgon project. With pipelines, of course, gives us and the facilities that go with it. That also gives us sort of increased reliability as well. The cost of these developments are so expensive that you can't build additional capacity into a plant and not use it. So the idea that we'd build a plant that was twice as big just in case Varanus Island happened to go out, it just is economically not going to happen. But I suppose the good thing is, as we see new facilities being built, that the collective sort of ability of other plants to sort of tweak and push at the boundaries the way the North West Shelf did in the current crisis means that we will have increasing flexibility to sort of accommodate outages in the future. Whether we can cover the full thing, of course, is the question. I just did want to make one other point here. I think, ideally you'd like to see a large domestic gas plant being built somewhere. And the sort of, I guess the example here is just really to say the importance of scale. This little chart here on the left-hand side just shows you, for the same sort of economic criteria for a 15% IRR, what the effect of a scale of a plant would be. And I said earlier how difficult it was to sort of aggregate up volumes to get a development to go. If we could get 100 terajoule a day development up, I've just normalised what the cost of that gas would be to give me a 15% return. If I could turn that into a 300 terajoule a day plant, effectively the cost of your gas is halved to generate the same return. So that importance of scale is quite critical. Now, what we tend to find is that you can get scale if you're looking at the domestic gas on the back of an LNG development. So we've had critics saying that LNG is bad for domestic gas because it's taking gas away. It's actually good for domestic gas because it brings gas to the beach, and they look at the economics of domestic gas quite differently. The chart on the right-hand side is attempting to show you that picture. If we took a 15% reservation on a 15 TCF gas field, a large LNG development, Gorgon, for example, and I'm not targeting Gorgon, Browse Project, Ichthys, for example, and you applied the 15% reservation, effectively that's 2.25 TCF of gas that would be reserved notionally under that 15% world. If you think about that, a 10 million tonne per annum plant, which is what that would be, will run for about 24, 25 years. The NPV contribution of that last 2 or 3 years that the 2.5 TCF represents is practically zero. It will make no difference to the economics of your LNG development. But domestic gas gives you the opportunity to take those molecules off the back of your project and accelerate them forward and produce them into the local gas market. And I think that's where LNG buyers, developers, will think about domestic gas in more as a, at the start of a project, more from an incremental economics point of view rather than an LNG parity sort of argument. LNG parity becomes quite important when you're trying to hear about, do I produce domestic gas or do I produce LNG? But up in front here, when you're looking at the sort of net present value of those molecules at the very end, they're much more valuable to you as domestic gas. So I think there are opportunities associated with these big LNG projects to see us get domestic gas into the state at a price that's potentially going to be substantially different to the way a standalone domestic gas developer may see it, maybe substantially lower. Okay, so just in terms of my conclusions, upstream, good cooperation, but there is really need for substantially improved transparency, and I think we need to sort all this out rather than sorting it on the fly during an emergency, to have a lot more planning sort of happening so that we've actually got this in place before we get to an emergency. I do think things like a single gas spec, for instance, might give us some flexibility, and one of the consequences of the new gas paradigm we're seeing is that the gas that we're discovering out in the deeper water has quite different compositions. As I said, high nitrogen content, not uniformly. Some of it's good, some of it's poor in terms of nitrogen. Some of it's high in CO2, some of it's not. The gas spec that we currently have is a very tight gas spec that was really designed around the North West Shelf. And whether a kind of a looser gas spec that was more broad wouldn't give us more of an ability to actually accommodate these different streams in a crisis is something worth thinking about in the mix as well. In terms of the outlook, we're really highly dependent on two plants potentially for quite a while, depending on what happens with sort of the growth of the domestic gas market. If it goes the way it sounds like it might go over the next few years, things could really slow down, and then really we're still quite exposed, I think, to just a couple of major hubs. But if some of the bigger projects, for example, like the Gorgon project, does happen to proceed with a domestic gas component, that will certainly relieve the situation somewhat. And I just come back to the thing that sort of says, I think we can't assume that these plants are going to operate reliably for and just be out for a day or two at a time. These low probability events, and they are very low probability, that have major consequences, need to be planned for. And there are sorts of solutions like the sorts of thing Ken was talking about where we can, without huge costs, mitigate these risks to a large extent. But it does require forethought and planning and something that you've got to maintain live despite the fact that you've been running for 15 years without a major outage. That's probably about all I need to say. Thank you.